And I'll say good morning to everyone and say how delighted I am that you all made it here safe and sound. And that so many of you braved the weather. This doesn't happen very often in Vancouver, this degree of weather. And there are a few who didn't make it, who had flights delayed and canceled from Calgary, from Fort McMurray. Although I think he's still coming. We do have a few people who couldn't make it or will come late and join us, but I'm really pleased that you all are here. You're quite intrepid, and you are also quite brave to come out for a Dogen retreat, though you may not know it. Dogen has a reputation for being notoriously difficult to understand. And I always feel rather presumptuous when I teach one of these Dogen retreats. But I have benefited so much from Dogen's teachings, and from particularly our very first Zen Soto Zen teacher in Japan, Shohaku Okamura's teachings on Dogen's work. It feels like it's you know, really the deep roots of my practice. And so I want to share, both of us, I think, really wanted to make this part of our yearly schedule to take some time with Dogen. And I believe that with a little help decoding some of Dogen's language, some of the Zen and cultural references in it, that these teachings can open us to a way of practice that's deeply connected to and inclusive of everything in our daily lives and in this world, just as it is. In these retreats, we pick a text to focus on each time. And so we do a talk in the morning and in the afternoon, and then have some time for you to reflect and discuss as well and ask questions. And so that's different from usually a Dharma talk in a formal retreat. You don't take notes, you just sit and receive it, you know, and kind of let go of that need to understand everything, and it comes and it goes. And this is going to be that too. You are not going to understand every sentence in Dogen, for sure. I don't. But we will, engage in helping each other understand it. And so it's fine if you want to make some notes, and I will actually ask you to do some writing. The text that I've chosen this time is called Body and Mind, Study of the Way. It was written in 1242. So Dogen would have been 42 years old. He was born in 1200. And he wrote it towards the end of a 10-year span where he was establishing his first monastery in the outskirts of Kyoto. Michael and I actually found the location. It was hard to find. It's very obscure. It's a kind of working class area south of Kyoto, not marked well at all. We found it in an obscure little Japanese guidebook. And it's a kind of scruffy temple, small,
with
concrete built post-war, probably, hastily reconstructed. And there's one little plaque on a stone that says that this is where Dogen established his first monastery, which is such a contrast for any of you who've been to Aheiji, and some of you have. Aheiji, the monastery Dogen then founded in the mountains, beautiful, beautiful mountains, and that temple continues today, having been rebuilt numerous times due to fire and catastrophes, which is a beautiful and still very much functioning training monastery. So this was kind of when Dogen was really first launching his teaching career and introducing this new form of Zen practice to Japan. Because he had been to China in his early 20s. He went there with his own teacher, who was a Rinzai. Rinzai Zen was introduced one generation earlier to Kyoto. And Dogen went with his Rinzai teacher to China and found really his source teacher there. His own teacher died there. Dogen was there about 5 years and then returned and first spent maybe 3 years or so, 3 or 4 years in a hermitage. We found that location too. Again, very obscure. And on a mountainside south of Kyoto, and he just practiced alone, although gradually people started to come. And he taught informally and then started his first small monastery. And during that time, in that first monastery, he wrote many of the most important works that now form what's called the Shobo Genzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. In English, it's two volumes, two thick volumes. And we call the individual pieces within that fascicles, because each stands alone, and they were then compiled. So if you hear me use that word, that's what I'm referring to, the fascicles in the Shobo Genzo. So let's start with the title. That's what we always do with these. Shinjin Gakudo in Japanese. Consists of four characters, and I was going to make a nice bigger version, but I kind of I was going to actually get him to calligraph a nice version for me, but he was busy marking papers. So that's shows you what it looks like in not very beautiful characters. They're a little, you know, stiff, I think. But the first is body. Second is mind or heart-mind, right? I think it's important to note that the character for mind in Chinese and then Japanese is a pictograph of the four-chambered heart. So it locates mind not within our skull, but within the core of our body. You know, in the heart. And that's quite different from our Western view of mind. When you combine this character, Shin, with another character, Zo, that means organ, then it refers specifically to the heart that pumps blood through your body. But alone, it means mind. A mind that is both a feeling and a thinking mind. It also means a kind of spirit of a person or being, so that inanimate objects can also have this. And it's if it's used alone, it's the Japanese pronunciation is kokoro. You might have heard that word, kokoro. So then we come to the next character, which is to study, gaku, and do, the way. So the way, or path, or road, is the same do that's used in martial arts, like judo, aikido, or tea ceremony, sado, archery, kudo. It's all that same character, way. It's also the fourth noble truth taught by the Buddha. First noble truth, our life is characterized by suffering. Second, there's a cause for suffering. Third, the cause is our self-clinging, desire also includes aversion, our desire for things to be other than they are. And the fourth noble truth is that there is a way, a path to freedom from suffering, which is the path, the practice of the Eightfold Path. Now, it's curious to me that the character used for study here, Gaku, is different from the character used in Dogen's famous passage that many of you know from the Genjo Koan, which is another fascicle, another very, probably the core text of Dogen's, which translates usually as actualizing the fundamental point. And this famous passage is, to study the way is to study the self, to study the self is to forget the self, to forget the self is to be actualized by the 10,000 things. It goes on saying, just to paraphrase, usually the way we operate is thrusting ourselves forward into the 10,000 things. But this is a way of the 10,000 things coming forth to meet us. And we meet the 10,000 things. And so the verb for that passage for study is narao, or shu. And that verb for study is not academic study. It's often used for learning a skill or a language. And it has the meaning of to get to know intimately, to get acquainted with. It's also used in that way. And so it feels like a good verb to use for the study of the self, you know, to really get fully acquainted with our body and mind, you know, to know intimately. And this other character, Gaku, is the one that is used more for academic, systematic study. So I can't help but wonder if Dogen was implying a subtle difference here. I don't know that. But there's a lot of overlap between the two verbs and their usage, just like body and mind ultimately can't be separated. So the title. It's traditional in a Soto Zen talk to really start. Sometimes they spend an hour on the title. So I did it pretty quickly. But let's move on to the text. I've given you a translation by Kazuaki Tanahashi. He's a good friend of ours. He's also an artist, sort of a Renaissance man. He did the big red Enso on the scroll on the wall in the kitchen. And he translated the entire Shobogenzo with different English-speaking co-translators for different parts of it, many of them from San Francisco Zen Center. I have found a number of discrepancies and awkward points in the translation. I used to do translation myself, so I can't help myself if I find things that I question. So I have noted in bold on your text places where I prefer an alternative translation. Don't worry, we'll come to them at the time. And I've also looked at a couple of other sources, translations, which give better notes, and the original Japanese. So let's open to the beginning. And I'm going to ask people to volunteer to read some of this so you hear more voices than just mine. So if someone could read, and I've numbered these, and these numbers don't correspond to anything other than just this weekend. I put the numbers there. Okay, so if someone could read number one. Raise your hand if you would like to, Todd.
Without practice, the Buddha way cannot be attained. Without study, it remains remote. Nanyu Zen Master Dahui, said, "It is not that there is no practice and no realization. It is just that they cannot be divided. Not to study the Buddha way is to fall into the realm of outsiders and those without enlightenment. All preceding and succeeding Buddhas, without exception, are influenced by Zen practice, the Buddha way."
Thank you. So this kind of refers to Dogen's lifelong koan, a question that he really held central, which was the relationship between practice, realization, awakening. I'm avoiding using the word enlightenment. You know, it's too easy to get thrown off, I think, by that word. Practice, realization, and actualizing. How do we live it? This question was sparked in his early life as a monk. He was ordained at about the age of 14, having lost both parents, into the Tendai sect, which was it was before Zen arrived in Japan, and the Tendai sect was kind of combination of elements of esoteric Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, and meditation, chanting, and lots of rituals. It was a kind of syncretic practice. And one of the doctrines in Tendai Buddhism was the doctrine of original enlightenment, that our essential nature is Buddha nature. So the young Dogen wanted to know, if we're already enlightened, if we're already Buddha, why do we have to practice? Logical question, right? And Dogen takes up this question, this koan, in various ways throughout the Shobo Genzo. So here he is in this text making a strong pitch for the importance of practice and study. And he makes a reference to a famous exchange between the sixth Zen ancestor, Huineng, in 8th century China, and Nanyue, who was the monk who would become his successor. So the story goes that when Nanyue first went to Huineng to ask if he could study with him, Huineng asked him, "Where are you from?" And Nanyue replied, "From Mount Zong." Now, if you've heard many of these kinds of dialogues, you know that "where are you from" is not just a literal question, right? It's a koan, it's a Dharma question. Who are you? Where are you from? Yeah. So, of course, Huineng followed up with another question. What is it that thus comes? And Nanyue was stuck. He couldn't answer. He couldn't say a word. "Thus come one," or "one who comes from thusness," is one phrase that refers to the Buddha, Tathagata. If you hear that word, Tathagata, it means "thus come one," and it refers to the Buddha. Thusness, kind of a funny word, but it's been coined in English to describe this Buddhist concept of just right now, just as it is, life, the world, your life, my life, just as it is right now in this moment, manifesting. So Huineng is asking Nanyue, what is it that's manifesting right here, right now? And Nanyue couldn't answer. So he went away and practiced for 8 years and came back. And Huineng asked him again, what is it that thus comes? And Nanyue answered, speaking about it won't hit the mark. Okay, we know that. Can't be described. And Huineng asked him, does it rest on practice and realization? He's really pushing him.
Yeah.
And Nanyue said, it is not that there is no practice and no realization. It's just that they cannot be defiled. Okay, defiled is the way that's usually translated. I'm not fond of that word because it seems too close to sinfulness somehow. So I find it a little more helpful to think a little bit like in terms of maybe something that contaminates our clarity of mind or obscures, just like clouds, right? So there's not so much a value judgment on it, but that's clouded or contaminated, like muddy mud in the water, or stained is another word that is used sometimes. At any rate, Hui Neng liked that answer, and he said, this non-defilement or non-contamination, this has been upheld and sustained by all Buddhas. You are thus, I am also thus. So this story, Dogen is using or making reference to this story to remind us that practice and realization can't be divided. You know, it's not practice, 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 and then suddenly out here there's realization. That they're together all the time, manifesting. And he clearly takes this to be a really important story, and because he begins with it here, and he makes references to it over and over again in the Shobo Genzo, and clearly he really admires Nanyue, who became a famous teacher in his own right. So that's the introduction. Could someone read the next paragraph, number 2?
For the time being, let us say there are two approaches to studying the Buddha way. To study with mind and to study with body. To study with mind means to study with various aspects of mind, such as consciousness, emotion, and intellect. After resonating with the way and arousing the aspiration for enlightenment, take refuge in the great way of Buddha ancestor and devote yourself to the practice of way-seeking mind. Even if you have not yet aroused the way-seeking mind, follow the examples of Buddha ancestor who did arouse the way-seeking mind in former times.
Thank you. So Dogen's saying here, provisionally, let's look at studying with the mind and studying with the body. So we know that they're not separate, but let's just provisionally, for the time being, talk about them separately. And maybe it's pertinent to note that the word he's using now for study is a compound of the two I already mentioned, the one that means to be intimate with and the one that means to study. So shugaku, he's making a compound of them. Sorry.
What does study mean?
What does study mean? Well, I think that's what we'll be doing and talking about, here. In the sense I mentioned of the earlier, the first, to study the way is to study the self. We said, become intimate with, become deeply familiar with. You know, to be good observers and experiencers at the same time of our life, right? And so Dogen's going to say a little bit more about different kind of aspects or approaches to that study.
Isn't he trying to bring us to the non-dualistic thinking? Like, don't think study and mind are different concepts. They are manifest together. Mm-hmm.
Why don't we follow through for a bit, and I'll make some time for questions.
Okay.
At the end, because I think first just to really engage with his language and take it in, and then see where that takes us.
Okay.
Yeah. He mentions three aspects of mind based on three Sanskrit terms. Citta, which is the cognitive mind, mind of thought, intention and reason, and Hridaya. Do you want spelling on that? Hridaya. And this comes the closest to what we were talking about of kokoro, the heart mind, the feeling mind, feeling. The seat of our emotional lives, our embodied mind, we could call it.
Could you repeat the word, please?
Hridaya? I don't trust my pronunciation.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, don't worry about these terms. It's just that these are just acknowledging that we have these aspects, the different aspects of mind. And the next one is vridha, V-R-I-D-D-H-A, which refers to kind of the mature, experienced wisdom mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as integrated mind. These categories don't correspond particularly neatly to our Western categories of conscious and unconscious, or ego, id, and superego, so don't try and make them fit. But they offer us just another way to observe our minds, our body and mind. Dogen says that when we resonate with the Buddha way, when we learn about the Buddha way, this aspiration will arise to awaken. You know, we want to find another way to be in the world, to awaken. And we realize that it's not just for ourselves, but for all beings that we wish to awaken. And then from that, our commitment to practice emerges. And we take refuge in the path that the ancestors have followed before us. And that mind of awakening, that aspiration, is called bodhicitta. Bodhi, awakening, citta, mind. He'll talk about that again. Could someone read number 3? Yeah, Jen.
There is the aspiration for enlightenment. Bits and pieces of straightforward, naked mind. The mind of the ancient Buddhas, everyday mind, and the inseparable from the three realms mind. Sometimes you study the way by casting off the mind. Sometimes you study the way by taking up the mind. Either way, study the way with thinking and study the way not.
So again, Dogen is listing and giving us another list of different aspects of mind. The aspiration for enlightenment, bodhicitta, that I just mentioned. And then this curious phrase, bits and pieces of naked mind. And I'm going to come back to this afternoon and talk more about this one. Naked mind, moment by moment, is, I think, a little better translation. The mind of ancient Buddhas, everyday mind, and mind that's inseparable from the three realms, which is kind of a universal mind. Don't really worry about all these categories. He's just giving us, different aspects of mind. But here's the line that I think is really important. Sometimes you study the way by casting off the mind. Sometimes you study the way by taking up the mind. Either way, study the mind with thinking and study with not thinking. So let's think what Dogen means by this and what it means for our practice. to study the mind with thinking might seem a little bit shocking to us when we hear so much about not thinking. We think we're not supposed to think, right? When we're meditating, we're supposed to quiet our minds. Dogen's, this last line reminds us of Dogen's famous words from another text called the Fukan Zazengi, which is universal instructions for Zazen. It's his basic instructions, and we're going to chant that during our service today, where he says, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. And of course, we all say, huh? How can you think not thinking, non-thinking? What is non-thinking? Dogen is referencing another dialogue. Part of learning to read Dogen is realizing how much he's actually drawing on past. He's quoting all, and it's not always in quotes, and he's making references to earlier dialogues between Zen masters and their students. So here he's referencing another dialogue between Master Yaoshan and his student. Yaoshan was sitting Zazen, and the monk asked him, what are you thinking sitting there so still? And Yaoshan replied, I'm thinking of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? The monk asked. And Yaoshan replied, non-thinking. So that's the source. Now, in the strictest sense, the core practice of Soto Zen, which is called Shikantaza, or just sitting, is sitting with no object at all, not even breath concentration. I remember our first Soto Zen teacher, Shohaku Okumura, said it's not even breath awareness, in the sense of breath concentration, breath as object. Though we often teach that as an aid for people just getting started to stabilize the mind enough to do the practice, right? Breath and body awareness are important. But Shikantaza is just sitting with a keen awareness as body and mind manifest in each moment. Just as it is, each moment, just as it is. Not hanging on to anything, not pushing anything away. Just what arises and what passes. Now here's where a popular misconception of meditation practice comes in. I often hear people come in, maybe they've come in for the first time, and we're just giving them basic instructions, or they come to Doksan after practicing for a few months or even a few years and say, I can't do this. This is so hard. I can't stop my mind. I can't stop my thoughts. Have you ever had that problem? If you've ever tried, you know how hard the mind pushes back when you try to stop thinking, right? In our practice, there may be times when we are deeply quiet, deeply concentrated, deeply attentive, deeply still. And there are practices that deliberately cultivate those states of deep concentration. And sometimes those states of deep quiet arise within Shikantaza. But they're not our goal. And if we want those states too much, we're going to be in a state of constant dissatisfaction with our lives and our present experience. Our aim, if we can call it that, because it's not a goal, but our aim is to sit with the mind of non-attainment, you know, non-grasping. And be fully awake. Not turning away, not suppressing, not judging, and not clinging to what arises, not feeding it. Just giving, just attending, moment by moment. So if this is studying the way by casting off the mind, by not thinking, that doesn't mean blank, right? It just means a thought arises, it arises, and we let it go. Even if it perseverates, which of course the mind does, we open the awareness wider so that that perseverating thought can disperse within the wider awareness, right? Including the body. It's very important, we'll talk about this through the weekend, of to realize what we're leaving out, you know, in our awareness, because if we're on a perseverating thought, we're leaving out awareness of the body. We're leaving out awareness of the breath. So we need to be more spacious. So what is studying the way by taking up the mind? By thinking. You might imagine that reading and studying a text, like we're doing this weekend, would fall into that category, studying with the mind, with thinking. And in a sense it is, but Dogen's not going to let us get away with making it that simple. In another fascicle of the Shobo Genzo, called Reading a Sutra, he tells us how to read a sutra, how to read a text. And it's not the way we conventionally read an academic text or even a novel. Here's what he says. A sutra is a sutra of the entire self. We say this because you yourself are the self of all Buddha ancestors and the self of all sutras. Although it is called the self, it is not bound by you or I. It is a vital eyeball, a vital fist. Thus, there is remembering, reading, chanting, copying, receiving, and maintaining a sutra. All of these are the practice realization of Buddha ancestors. So he's saying, when you engage with a sutra, you use your mind, your voice, your memory, your hand copying. That used to be a practice, to copy the sutras, right? So it's a much more sort of embodied relationship and receiving the words rather than actively, you know, analyzing and trying to figure out. So he's telling us here a little bit about how to read him, how to read Dogen. And it's more, a little more akin to how we read poetry. To engage with our complete body-mind, with our senses, with image, with our, allow our conscious and unconscious mind to engage, to receive these words. But there's another practical way we can practice thinking beyond thinking. Practicing the way thinking beyond thinking. Dogen doesn't say this, so I think I'm going out on the limb a little bit. But when he says, sometimes you study the way by casting off the mind, sometimes you study the way by taking up the mind, I'm reminded by what happens when we are sitting in zazen. And sometimes mind content arises, right, and drops away with just our mindful attention. But sometimes mind content is really persistent, right, even obsessive. And it's so hard to put that down, that conversation that we had yesterday, those hurtful words someone said to us, right? Or our own failure to meet up to our expectations, you know. Hard to let those things go. Those old habit patterns kick in and we spin our wheels deeper and deeper in the rut. Right? So there are several possible approaches we can use. We can try to wrestle that perseverating mind into submission. If you've tried that, you know it doesn't work so well. If those thoughts are very persistent, we can bring a kind of keen, non-judgmental, moment-to-moment awareness. To the thoughts themselves. And we can see them with our Dharma eye. And what I mean by that is we can penetrate to see their conditioned nature. You know, so we're not seeing that thought as something we believe so firmly, but we can see deeper into the roots of what formed that thought. And we can see its ultimate insubstantiality. We can see it as a condition and a temporary or provisional thing, and a limited thing. Our thoughts are so limited. You know, they're always so partial, little fragments of the whole big picture. So when we see with our Dharma eye, and I don't mean we do this in an analytical way, we see just by attending and this comes. Sometimes, I said, you know, we don't want to wrestle our mind into submission, but sometimes a firm, loving stop can be effective. It just interrupts that feedback loop enough that you can let it go. You know, it's like a dog with a bone. Stop. Just stop. But sometimes it takes more than that. Sometimes it takes this kind of engaged attention that I just mentioned. And then sometimes we need to bring our attention to our embodied experience of that mind state. Right? Where do we feel the constriction in our body? What's our bodily experience of this state? What's the quality of our breath? Simply doing that brings us more to the present without forcing it, and allows what the great Japanese teacher Uchiyama Roshi called opening the hand of thought. There's this releasing of the thought that comes when we can connect to our bodily experience more. We relax that grip. We open our heart and mind, and we make room for that more expanded view of reality that allows for compassion to arise and wisdom, both. And in the arising of compassion and wisdom, we realize that we are not the ones suffering here, that suffering is arising. Suffering is arising, and that this is our human condition, and we share it. We share it with the world. In fact, we can even offer it up. I am attending to this suffering that's arising, and I offer it up. I offer it up to the world, to the other beings, that we may all be free. So you don't have to be analytic about these strategies. You can intuitively and deliberately direct your attention. As you get more experienced with practice, you can kind of feel when it's skillful to direct your attention in these ways. And to, in a sense, make a more active inquiry into the nature of mind and body. And sometimes the guidance of a teacher is helpful, a little check-in and feedback, if you, you know, to say, what do I need to be doing here? What would be helpful? But you can learn also to trust your own sense. Okay, let's continue. Could someone read number 4? Lee?
will authentically inherit and transmit the brocade robe to say, you have attained my marrow, to make three bows and return to the original place, or to pound rice and receive the robe. This is studying mind with mind.
Okay, so here Dogen is referring to specific stories from early China, Chinese Chan, of transmission from historic ancestors, Dharma transmission from historic ancestors to their disciples. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all these stories, but the point here is that there's not something being transmitted from teacher to student. What there is an opening, an attunement that goes beyond self and other, between teacher and student, or between us and world, there's transmission, right? There's an expression of the Dharma that we could say co-arises. An enactment, in a sense, of the saying, Buddha Dharma cannot be known by a person alone. Only a Buddha and a Buddha can thoroughly master it. Dogen writes a whole fascicle called Only a Buddha and a Buddha. And it's wonderful. It comes from a saying in the Lotus Sutra. Only a Buddha and a Buddha can fully realize the Dharma. Okay, number five, please. Remind me your name.
Wendy.
Wendy, thanks.
Shaving the head and wearing the robe is itself turning the mind and illuminating the mind. Leaving the castle and entering the mountains is leaving one mind and entering one mind. To directly enter the mountains is to think not thinking. To leave the world behind is beyond thinking.
Thank you. So here, when he says leaving the castle, he's referring to the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, leaving the safety and luxury of his family home and going out as quite a young man, going out into the world to wander, to find his way, to awaken. And this is what we all do in less dramatic ways. When we take up the practice, we make some kind of intent to leave behind things, ways of being that aren't wholesome for us. We let go of our conventional conditioned views and habit patterns in search of a more spacious way of being in the world. Number six, please, someone. Louise?
Those who have rolled up this matter with wide open eyeballs are two or three bushels. Those who have tampered with it by karma consciousness are thousands and millions of pieces. When you study the way in this manner, having merit, the result may come of itself. Having the result, merit may not arrive. You will secretly borrow the nostrils of Buddha ancestors and have them exhale. Taking up the hoof of a muck donkey, you will have it imprint the seal of enlightenment. These are authentic examples of the ancient tradition.
Okay, that all sounds pretty cryptic. But the gist of this passage seems to be that to practice in the way that Dogen's encouraging us to practice is not an abstract matter. We have to engage in the concrete world around us in all its particular details without worrying about results or karmic merit, which may or may not come in any obvious way from our efforts. We just breathe in and out with the Buddha ancestors, right? And fully meet each moment. And I will confess that I don't know what he means when he says, take up the hoof of a donkey. No, nobody gives a footnote on that. I've looked and looked. Donkeys do appear in the Zen literature, but I don't quite get it. This imprint, the seal of enlightenment, means a Dharma transmission seal.
Might you not just get kicked into it?
So please, use your own imagination here, and that would be fine. Let's keep going. Number 7, please. Megan.
Now mountains, rivers, earth, the sun, the moon, and stars are mine. Mind. At just this moment, what is it that appears directly in front of you? Mountains, rivers, and earth do not merely mean the mountains, rivers, and earth where you are standing. There are various kinds of mountains, such as Great Sumeru and Small Sumeru. Some mountains extend widely, some rise up steeply. A billion worlds and innumerable lands can be found in a mountain. There are mountains suspended in form. There are mountains suspended in emptiness.
Thank you. So again, this is classic Dogen language.
Oh, yeah.
And he uses these images from nature to say that our minds are completely formed and in relationship to the world around us. The mountains, the rivers, the earth, sun, moon, and stars. In such variety. Dogen brings in the interpenetrating reality of form and emptiness that we know from the Heart Sutra. You know, form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. This realization that all existence is continuously passing into and out of form. Right? In a boundless net of interconnection, or as Thich Nhat Hanh calls it, interbeing. He goes on describing this reality of myriad diverse forms within boundless oneness. That's what this description is. Could somebody read 8, please?
Yeah. There are also many kinds of waters, heavenly rivers, earthly rivers, and 4 great rivers. There are lakes without heat. In the great northern continent, there are 4 Anavatapta lakes. There are oceans and rivers. There are oceans and pools. Earth is not necessarily ground, and ground is not necessarily earth. There is earth ground, there is mind ground, there is treasure ground. Although the varieties are innumerable, it is not that there is no earth, but without doubt is a world where emptiness is earth. The sun, the moon, and stars are seen by humans and by devas are not the same, and the views of them by various beings differ widely. Views about one mind differ as well. Yet these views are nothing but mind. Is it inside or outside? Does it come or go? Is there more of it at birth or not? Is there less of it at death or not? How do we understand this birth and death and views of birth and death?
Okay, thank you. Just a couple of things. Those Anavatapta lakes are apparently the source of the Ganges, 4 streams that flow into the Ganges. And that line that I've underlined with the question mark, I did not go back and put, that is a discrepancy in the translation, and the better translation of that line I will give you now. But don't feel like you have to write it down. The better translation is, viewed from the perspective of one mind, everything is undifferentiated. So what this whole, you want me to say that again?
Yeah.
Viewed from the perspective of one mind, everything is undifferentiated. What this whole passage is saying is, or pointing to, is the relativity of views of sentient beings. And yet all these views are manifestations of consciousness. So what does the world look like, or feel like, or smell like to a dragonfly? Once a dragonfly landed on my chest, I was in the middle of a meditation retreat.
Wow.
And I had this terrible pain in my shoulder. You ever have terrible pain in between your shoulder blades during a meditation retreat? It was just wouldn't let go. It was, oh, so, just like a talons. And we did outdoor walking meditation, and this dragonfly went thump right on my chest, and it had in its jaws a mayfly. And it crunched up the mayfly. Audibly. As I looked into its eyes. I didn't actually think anything. I just was totally absorbed. And it ate the mayfly and buzzed away. And the pain in my shoulders vanished. Mm-hmm. It was gone. It was like this amazing moment. But I can't, like, just looking into the eyes of a dragonfly, you know, like, what does the world look like to a dragonfly? Mm-hmm. What does it look like to an octopus? Mm-hmm. The mind of an octopus, they're really smart. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about octopuses? Mm-hmm. They're the smartest thing without a backbone.
Yeah.
What would the world be like to an earthworm? Why do we think our views are so definitive? They are so partial. There's so much still that we can't perceive and can't know. What happens to mind before and after death? Does it come or go? There are no easy answers to these questions. But it may be that what Dogen is calling mind is more vast than we can imagine, far beyond the confines of this skull, or what they like to call in Zen, the skin bag. Okay, number 9, someone? Not yet.
All this is merely a moment or two of mind. A moment or two of mind is a moment of mountains, rivers, and earth, or two moments of mountains, rivers, and earth. Because mountains, rivers, earth, and so forth neither exist nor do not exist, they are not large or small, not attainable or unattainable, not knowable or unknowable, not penetrable or impenetrable. They neither change with realization nor change without realization. Just wholeheartedly accept with trust that to study the way with mind is this mountains, rivers, and earth mind itself, thoroughly engaged in studying the way.
So how about that? He's saying just wholeheartedly accept with trust that to study the way with mind is this whole vast consciousness. And he's saying the reality of the universe does not change with or without our realization. There's an old Zen saying, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. There's Donovan made a song of it long ago. If you remember that, you know how old you are. Meaning that when we in conventional reality, we see a mountain. And then when we see with our Dharma eye, we see that that mountain is impermanent, that it's made up of minerals, it was formed by, you know, volcanic activity or by plates crunching together, and that it is subject to erosion by water and wind, that big mountain is constantly changing. As Dogen says in his Mountains and Waters Sutra, blue mountains are always walking. And then when we see this with our Dharma eye, then we can see the mountain at the same time again. We can see the mountain right now. This is what he means by trusting that to study the way with the mind is this mountains, rivers, and earth mind itself, thoroughly engaged in studying the way. Okay, one more paragraph. Somebody, Michael, read it. Number 10.
This trust and acceptance is neither large nor small, neither existent nor non-existent. To study in this manner, understand that home is no home, abandoning home and entering the homeless life, is not measurable as large or small, near or far. It is far beyond beginning or end, beyond ascending or descending. Unrolling the matter, it is 7 or 8 feet. Responding immediately, it benefits the self and others. All this is nothing but the study of the way.
Responding immediately benefits self and others. Our simple practice of shikantaza can be misconstrued as passive and complacent. But it's not. Dogen, what he's describing here is a kind of full engagement with the dynamic reality of our lives that makes this practice so relevant to daily life in our times, of benefit to self and others. So now, I'm finally going to stop talking. I'm going to ask you to take a moment to take out a pen and some paper. If you don't have paper, there's some blank on the towards the end of your text there. And does anyone need a pen? Where's that? Little container of pens.
It's right down here.
Yeah. Yeah. Pass that around to whoever needs. Okay, and I'm just going to give you 3 questions. This is not a test. It's not even a quiz. I'm just going to give you 3 questions just to do a little reflection. Just write down what comes to mind, okay?
And a pen?
Okay. Okay, here goes. First question is, what does home leaving mean to you? What does home leaving mean to you?
Home leaving?
Home leaving, yeah. You know, like the Buddha left his home. Monks are called home leavers. You know, monks who completely give up their home. But we're not. You know, we're people living in the world. We have jobs and families. So in terms of your own practice, what does home leaving mean? What does, you know, the letting go? Yeah, that's your first question. Second one, how do you enter the mountains of your mind? You can just jot these down for a minute.
Again, sorry?
The mountains of?
How do you enter the mountains of your mind?
Of?
The mountains of your mind. How do you enter the mountains of your mind? Third one, what role does trust... I'll say it again.
Thank you.
What role does trust and acceptance play? What role does trust and acceptance play for you in your practice and life? Okay, you don't have to answer these all extensively. If one resonates and the other one doesn't, that's okay. Just spend a few minutes just jotting down what comes to you.
And I didn't ask the last of the third question.
What role does trust and acceptance play?
Play.
Play, yeah, in your practice, your life. Yeah. Okay?
Yeah.